Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama.
And now chapter 3. Prabhupada had postponed the Mayapur cornerstone laying ceremony until Gaur Purnima, the appearance day of Lord Chaitanya, February 29, 1972. He had requested a big festival, with a pandal and free feasting for guests. His disciples from all over the world would attend. He said, quote, I want very much to hold this function this year with all of my students. It is a very important day, and it will be a great service to Srila Bhaktivinod Thakur and to his son, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So please arrange for this program. Unquote. In December, when the war had broken out between India and Pakistan over Bangladesh, near Mayapur, the Indian government had forbidden foreigners to stay in the northern area of West Bengal. The devotees had vacated, returning a few weeks later when the war had ended. They had continued arranging for the festival, and a few days before Gaur Purnima, Prabhupada arrived to stay with them. When Prabhupada saw a banner on bamboo poles, Welcome Srila Prabhupada, he remarked, I don't know if my godbrothers will like this. He had already heard that some of his godbrothers objected to his taking the same title as their spiritual master, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Prabhupada. He had not actually taken the name, but his disciples had given him the name a few years ago in America. In May 1968, while in Boston, Prabhupada had been dictating a letter and had mentioned to his secretary that Swamiji was a third-class title for the spiritual master. Then why do we call you Swamiji? His secretary had asked. The spiritual master, Prabhupada had replied, is usually addressed by names like Gurudeva, Vishnupad, or Prabhupada. May we call you Prabhupada? His secretary had asked. Prabhupada had replied, yes, and his disciples had switched from Swamiji to Prabhupada. One of the devotees had inquired further from Prabhupada about the meaning of the word and had published a statement in Back to Godhead magazine. It read, quote, Prabhupada. The word Prabhupada is a term of the utmost reverence in Vedic religious circles, and it signifies a great saint even among saints. The word actually has two meanings. First, one at whose feet, or pad, there are many Prabhus, a term meaning master, which the disciples of a guru use in addressing each other. The second meaning is one who is always found at the lotus feet of Krishna, the supreme master. In the line of disciplic succession through which Krishna consciousness is conveyed to mankind, there have been a number of figures of such spiritual importance as to be called Prabhupada. Srila Rupa Goswami Prabhupada executed the will of his master, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and therefore he and his associate Goswamis are called Prabhupada. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami Thakur executed the will of Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur, and therefore he is also addressed as Prabhupada. Our spiritual master, Om Vishnupad 108, Sri Srimad Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj, has, in the same way, executed the will of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada in carrying the message of love of Krishna to the Western world, and therefore we American and European humble servants of His Divine Grace from all the different centers of the Sankirtan movement have followed in the footsteps of Srila Rupa Goswami Prabhupada. Yes. Everyone concerned had been happy about the title Prabhupada, and no one had foreseen the envy the name would uncover. How could Prabhupada compete for the honor due his own spiritual master? He was fixed as the humble servant of his spiritual master. The members of ISKCON saw no harm in calling their spiritual master Prabhupada, and there could be no stopping them. He was their Prabhupada. They had even printed A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada on their invitations for the Gaur Purnima festival. But Prabhupada knew it would raise the eyebrows of certain of his more critical godbrothers. When inspecting the living accommodations for the devotees, Prabhupada found spacious white canvas tents, one for the men and one for the women, with fluorescent lighting inside. A large pandal tent stood in the center of the other tents, and a small tent in the rear served as a kitchen. Immediately surrounding the small compound were rice fields. The ground, therefore, was slightly moist, and the wet fields bred large mosquitoes, which emerged at sunset. Conditions were primitive, but many of these devotees were the same disciples who had traveled with Prabhupada for a year and a half in India, sometimes living in dirty dharmashalas with bare rooms, and sometimes living in cold tents in Allahabad. The devotees had not come to Mayapur to be comfortable, but to serve Prabhupada. In future years, by the result of their efforts, many, many devotees would be able to gather comfortably in Mayapur in the spacious buildings Prabhupada was planning. Well aware that Westerners were unaccustomed to the austerities of living in India, Prabhupada wanted to provide facilities so his disciples could feel comfortable and be able to focus their stay in India on spiritual life without distracting inconveniences. Therefore, he was pushing them to help in various ways to establish a Mayapur building with running water, electricity, and other conveniences. Prabhupada's dwelling was a simple thatched Bengali hut, about 12 feet square, with a dirt floor. A thin partition divided the main room from the servants' quarters. In front was a small veranda, and in back, a garden where Prabhupada could sit and take massage. Also in back were a hand pump for bathing and an outhouse. When the devotees apologized for offering Prabhupada such a humble residence, he replied that he liked the natural simplicity. "Even if you build me the biggest palace," he said, "still I would prefer to live here." While living so simply in Mayapur, Prabhupada spoke of his vision of a grand project yet to come. Although the deities of Radha Madhava, whom he had worshipped at the 1971 Ardha Kumbha Mela in Allahabad, were installed in a tent, he spoke of a marble palace. He also spoke of first-class accommodations for guests and devotees, although as yet he had little to offer. Living simply and happily in his thatched hut, he gathered his disciples together and told them of his plans. At his request, devotees had built a small model of the proposed first major building, and there were also drawings of the proposed temple of human understanding. He wanted to build a Mayapur city, he said, with quarters for each of the four social classes of the Varnashram institution. Tatpara recalls, "When Prabhupada would go to the Western countries, he would be interviewed by many great persons. But when he came to Mayapur, he was talking so friendly, sometimes taking juice or giving instructions, and he lived simple like a villager. The Western devotees think sometimes of Prabhupada in one lila only, like a great king. But when he comes to India, he is like another person. He was laughing and talking like a friend." Bhavananda remembers, "In his straw house, Prabhupada sat on a bamboo platform. There was a bed and some mats on the floor, that was all. He was happier there than anywhere. We put a fan in there too, and Prabhupada liked it. He liked it because it was so simple. There was an outhouse, but he didn't mind it at all. He was relishing everything. At that time, he made Jayapataka and me co-directors of Mayapur. He made four signers on the checking account for the building construction. In India, just to open up an account is very difficult. We were seeing that part of Prabhupada where he was very strict because he knows the difficulties you can run into. If you don't fill out the proper forms, the bank can even keep your money. Or you may want to close your account and they won't let you. Our mood was splayed out. We were babies. So Prabhupada was training us in keeping accounts and management. Jananivasa recalls, "The first time Prabhupada came to see the deities, he said, 'Who is dressing the deities?' Someone said, 'Jananivasa.' The deities were just standing on a tile platform with no decoration. They were just standing there, but Prabhupada looked on them so lovingly. He used to come and take darshan every day. One time he came to the deity room and I wasn't there. There were some Indian people taking darshan, and I had gone to get them a Back to Godhead magazine from a room about 10 feet away. When I came back, Prabhupada was there. He was also taking darshan, but he said, 'You should always be standing here. People are coming, but no one is here.' I said, 'Srila Prabhupada, I just went to get a Back to Godhead. It is only 10 feet away.' But he looked at me as if to say, 'You are defending yourself again, making excuses.' Then he told Bhavananda, 'This boy, Jananivasa, should have some help. He can't do everything. He is an ordinary person.'" The five-day Gaur Purnima festival featured 24-hour kirtan with groups of devotees chanting in two-hour shifts. Each morning, the main body of devotees would form a kirtan procession and go out visiting Navadvipa's holy sites. The neem tree under which Lord Chaitanya was born, the house of Srinivasa Acharya, where Lord Chaitanya and his associates had performed nocturnal kirtan, the spot where the Qazi had tried to stop Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan, the residence of Bhaktivinod Thakur. Often Bhaktivinod Thakur had stood in front of this house, Prabhupada told the devotees, and looked out across the Jalangi River toward where Srila Prabhupada now had his land. Throughout the day, and especially in the evenings, the devotees would gather on the stage of the orange-striped pandal, where Radha Madhava stood at stage center, within a traditional Bengali singhasan of carved banana stalks covered with colored foil and flower garlands. Prabhupada would have his disciples do most of the public speaking, with Achyutananda Swami lecturing in Bengali as the main speaker. Hundreds of people came and went in a steady stream, and the devotees distributed Bengali, English, and Hindi Back to Godhead magazines. In the evenings, they would present a slideshow or a film. Prabhupada was especially pleased to watch the prasadam distribution from his window, hundreds of villagers squatting in long rows, eating khichdi from round leaf plates. "Continue this forever," Prabhupada told his disciples. "Always distribute prasadam." Even without a building, Prabhupada's preaching in Mayapur was significant. While other nearby mats were also observing Gaur Purnima, mostly by hosting Calcutta widows who paid a fee to live a few days in a temple and visit the holy places of Navadvipa, Prabhupada's pandal program was the most vigorous celebration and drew the most visitors. The birthplace of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Prabhupada said, had no meaning without preaching. Except for this time of the year, very few people visited Mayapur. "Which is more important?" Prabhupada asked. "Lord Chaitanya's birthplace or his activities?" "It is his activities, his karma. His activities are more important than his janma or place of birth." The activities of Lord Chaitanya were chanting Hare Krishna and distributing love of God to all people, and this should be the activity of devotees in Mayapur. On Gaur Purnima Day, 10 of Prabhupada's sannyasi godbrothers visited to participate along with Prabhupada's disciples and hundreds of visitors in the dedication and cornerstone laying ceremony. Prabhupada was gracious and friendly toward his godbrothers, and he was gratified that they could all sit together to dedicate the world headquarters of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Sitting on a cushion next to the sacrificial arena, chanting on japa beads, Prabhupada initiated 6 Bengali devotees and awarded the sannyas order to a young American disciple. Then Prabhupada's godbrothers spoke, each expressing appreciation of Prabhupada's work in the West. Finally, they all gathered around the pit, 5 feet square and 15 feet deep. Certain articles had been collected to be placed inside the pit in accordance with the scriptures. 5 kinds of flowers, 5 kinds of grains, 5 kinds of leaves, 5 kinds of metal, 5 kinds of nectar, 5 kinds of colors, 5 kinds of fruits, and 5 kinds of jewels. Prabhupada's godbrother, Puri Maharaj, descended a ladder into the pit to put coconuts and banana leaves in a pot and to place this, along with flowers, onto the altar of bricks. Next, Prabhupada entered the pit, carrying a box with a gold, ruby-eyed murti of Ananta Shesha. Earlier that morning in his hut, Prabhupada had confidentially shown a few disciples the murti. "This is Lord Ananta," he had said, "the serpent bed on which Lord Vishnu rests. He will hold the temple on his head." Prabhupada now placed Ananta Shesha on the altar of bricks and climbed back up the ladder. Then on Prabhupada's blissful invitation, everyone began to toss in offerings of flowers and money, followed by handfuls of earth. Although Prabhupada's godbrothers had praised his work on Gaur Purnima Day, several of them returned a few days later to complain about the use of the title Prabhupada. Prabhupada asked his disciples to leave the room. When they were alone, one of the sannyasi godbrothers began challenging Prabhupada in Bengali. "Why are you using Prabhupada? You have no right. This is our Prabhupada's title. You cannot take it." "I did not take it," Prabhupada replied. "They are calling me Prabhupada. What can I do?" Although the sannyasi godbrother then began to criticize Prabhupada for not joining their preaching and for awarding the sacred thread and sannyas order to Westerners, mainly the godbrothers wanted an explanation for his use of the title Prabhupada. "Brahmananda Maharaj," Prabhupada called, "bring me a copy of my letterhead." When Brahmananda Swami returned with the stationery, Prabhupada showed it to his godbrothers. The letterhead read, "Tridandi Goswami A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. No Prabhupada." This proved that he himself did not use the title. This simple demonstration pacified his godbrothers, and then he invited them to take prasadam with him, while his disciples served. Later in his hut, Prabhupada talked with his disciples about envy. "A devotee could judge his own advancement by how free he was from envy," he said. In the spiritual world, envy was conspicuous by its absence. Although all the liberated associates of Krishna were trying their best to serve Krishna in a kind of competition, everyone was pleased with one another. If Radharani or a favorite gopi pleased Krishna, the other gopis did not think ill of her but thought, "Oh, how nicely she has served Krishna. Let me try to offer some nice service to Krishna so he will be even more pleased." To be envious was materialistic. Prabhupada wished his godbrothers had taken a different point of view. He wished they had not minded his being called Prabhupada by his disciples. He was also sorry that some of his godbrothers couldn't sincerely praise his work. If Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati was working successfully through him, why should they be disturbed? Why not accept his work and be happy that the mission of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was being spread effectively? They should see it as Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati's work, the work of their own spiritual master. It was also their work, their responsibility, and they should recognize that through Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj, it was being wonderfully done. At the ceremony, they had praised his work, so if they didn't mind praising him, then why not admit that for hundreds of Westerners whom he had saved from hell, he was Prabhupada, that singular pure devotee whom they always thought of as seated at the lotus feet of Krishna. In terms of authorized books produced and distributed, numbers of devotees initiated and engaged in devotional service, and numbers of temples opened, no one could compare. Of course, in one sense, all of Prabhupada's godbrothers were equally praiseworthy, as long as they followed the basic instructions of Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, chanted Hare Krishna, and avoided sinful life. But if analysis or criticism was to be made with such scrutiny, then let the preaching records be scrutinized. Who, above all, was extending the mercy of Lord Nityananda and making such tremendous gains on behalf of Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, gains that had previously seemed impossible? According to Chaitanya Charitamrita, if a preacher could spread the chanting of Hare Krishna, then he must be accepted as empowered by God. Prabhupada was empowered, yet he conducted himself very humbly, with no assistance from others. He had repeatedly invited his godbrothers to join him in the West and take their places beside him as preachers in the Krishna consciousness movement. Why had they not come forward to assist him in their spiritual master's mission instead of complaining about him, the one godbrother who was carrying out Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati's mission? It was not the place of Prabhupada's disciples to criticize, and he had sternly warned them that they had no position to do so. They should treat his godbrothers as disciples of Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, and therefore as on the level of their own spiritual master. Nevertheless, Prabhupada's disciples became sorry to see this lack of respect for their spiritual master. They could be humble and not protest, but how could they be affectionate toward persons who criticize their spiritual master and his Krishna consciousness movement? After the five-day festival, Prabhupada left Mayapur for Vrindavan, where he planned to hold another groundbreaking ceremony. The Mayapur land was still completely undeveloped, and Prabhupada urged his disciples in India to continue collecting the necessary funds. He said, quote, "We are making a very gorgeous plan at Mayapur, and if you all together can give shape to this plan, it will be unique in the whole world. It will be a world center for teaching spiritual life. Students from all over the world will come, and we shall revolutionize the atheistic and communistic tendencies of rascal philosophers. So we must be responsible for this great task. Not for a single moment shall we be without ISKCON thoughts. That is my request to you all." Unquote. February 1972. During Prabhupada's absence from Vrindavan, the devotees had been unable to persuade Mr. S. to grant legal permission for ISKCON to use the land. Prabhupada had insistently directed one of his Indian-born disciples, Kshiro Dakshayi, to acquire from Mr. S. an actual deed. Kshiro Dakshayi had pleaded with Mr. S., and seeing Mr. S.'s indecision, he had spoken with Mrs. S. and then with the two of them together. Mr. and Mrs. S. had agreed that since they could not decide, they would put the matter before Srimati Radharani herself. Mrs. S. had asked Kshiro Dakshayi to take two slips of paper and to write yes on one and no on the other. These she had folded and placed before the family deity of Radha Krishna. She had then asked Shiro Dakushai to pick up one of the papers. Shiro Dakushai had done so, and in the presence of Mr. and Mrs. S. and Radha and Krishna, he had opened the piece of paper on which was written the word, Yes. When Prabhupada had heard the news, he had been joyous and had said, I am especially pleased upon you that you have secured the S land for Krishna. Now let us cooperate to build up a wonderful center there in Vrindavan. In March 1972, Prabhupada returned to Vrindavan to sign the deed with Mr. S. and to perform the groundbreaking ceremony. With permission from the Goswamis at the Radha Damodar Temple, he arranged for quarters for his disciples so they would have a place to reside while the temple at Ramanreti was under construction. Yamuna recalls, It just so happened that on the morning that the Goswamis were to sign an agreement with Prabhupada for use of the rooms at Radha Damodar, the electricity went out. Prabhupada's secretary had only an electric typewriter, so I reminded Prabhupada that I was trained in writing calligraphy. I had my writing pens with me, so immediately Prabhupada drafted the writing that he wanted, and I took it into another room, sat down, and hand-lettered a contract with gold embossing on all the capitals. Within 15 minutes, we presented it to Srila Prabhupada. Before the Goswamis, Prabhupada held up the document with pleasure and said, Just see, my disciples are expert in everything. Now the devotees would be allowed to reside above his rooms at Radha Damodar Temple, and they would also have access to his rooms for cleaning. Prabhupada felt it was a grand occasion that there was something in writing for the preservation of his rooms in the Radha Damodar Temple. To close the transaction for the land in Ramanreti, Prabhupada and Mr. S. met at the magistrate's court in Mathura. In the presence of lawyers, they completed the formalities. Prabhupada saw it as Krishna's grace that he had acquired a good plot of land in Vrindavan, and writing to his GBC secretaries in America, he asked them to send as many men as possible to help in the new project. He described his intentions for raising up a very excellent center to revive the spiritual life for Vrindavan on behalf of Rupa and Jiva Goswamis. Prabhupada told Shiro Dakushai, I want on this occasion huge prasadam should be prepared, and every man in Vrindavan should be invited and take prasadam. 2 days later, with 100 people attending, Prabhupada held the cornerstone laying ceremony at Ramanreti. Again he descended into the ceremonial pit and placed the deity of Ananta, on whose head the temple would rest. But late that night, the land was attacked. An elderly Indian widow, with local fame as a sadhu, became angry that Mr. S. had not given her the land, which she had several times requested. During the night, she sent gundas, or criminals, to dismantle the brick foundation of the ceremonial cornerstone and to desecrate the pit, which had just that day been filled with flowers and religious objects. The gundas dug open the hole, threw garbage into it, and stole the posted sign announcing the land's new ownership. Prabhupada was in his room at the Radha Damodar Temple when he heard what had happened. He became angry and told his disciples to show the deed to the police. That night, several policemen guarded the land, and when the hired gundas came again, the police accosted them and warned that if they caused any more trouble, they would be arrested. And that was the end of that. Prabhupada had several times said that by becoming a devotee, one gains many enemies. The incident also served to confirm Prabhupada's conviction that ISKCON's taking possession of the land should be followed as quickly as possible by construction of a temple. They should at least encircle the land with a fence build small huts, and live on the land while preparing for temple construction. Tejas recalls, "This will be the Krishna Balaram temple," Prabhupada said. "We didn't really know what was going on. We all thought it was so far away. It was really the boondocks, Raman Reti. Nobody was out there. It was such an isolated place, and there were lots of dacoits living out there. We thought, if we're going to have a temple out here, no one will ever come. But Prabhupada said, wherever there is Krishna, everyone will come." Prabhupada's secretary, Shyamasundara, wrote to a godbrother about the newly acquired Vrindavan property. He said, quote, "Earlier in the day, before breakfast, Prabhupada sewed up the 4,800 square yard gift plot in Raman Reti, where Krishna used to sport with friends in the forest, about 10 minutes walk from Radha Damodar. Prabhupada surveyed the land with the rope from his mosquito net, bargained for, drew plans for, drew up the deed for, went to Mathura Magistrate's Court for, and signed, sealed, and delivered in an instant. Prabhupada has asked me to request you that at least 50 men from the U.S. must come to India immediately. At last, we have got a solid program in India. Huge projects at Mayapur, Vrindavan, and Bombay. All the lands are acquired, arrangements made, and everything by Prabhupada. But only a few of us men are here to struggle with an immense task. The biggest by far within the society of developing these three places, and believe me, these three projects are more dear to Prabhupada than any yet contemplated." Unquote. In the month while Prabhupada was away from Bombay, he had left on February 10th, the payment of 50,000 rupees was duly made. Slowly at first, a few devotees moved to the Juhu land, living in a tent. At night, the rats and mosquitoes would disturb the devotees' sleep. While attempting to clear the overgrown weeds, they came upon empty liquor bottles and overflowing sewage. Without Prabhupada present, their resolution grew weak. But then Brahmananda Swami returned from Calcutta, where he had been with Srila Prabhupada. Brahmananda Swami was inspired, and he gave the Bombay devotees new impetus. They would have to clear the land and raise a pandal right away. Brahmananda Swami had never put on a pandal program before, but he hired a contractor to build several chatai or palm frond houses for the devotees and a festival tent. Even before the construction could begin, however, the devotees would have to thoroughly clear the land. Mr. Sethi, a neighbor and life member, hired a work crew to cut down the weeds and vegetation, and several life members and friends in Bombay also came forward to assist. Mr. N offered to help by sending one of his assistants, Mr. Matar, to organize the hired laborers in clearing the fields. The devotees also worked in preparation for Prabhupada's return. Sri Sri Radha Rasa Vihari arrived at Hare Krishna land in a taxi, riding across the laps of several devotees. They had moved before, and this time their residence was a tent. They had first come to be with the devotees of Bombay during the pandal program at Cross Maiden in downtown Bombay. On that occasion, there had been a procession to Chaupati Beach, and when the devotees had arrived, Radha Rasa Vihari, beautifully dressed and decorated, and installed in an ornate palanquin, had been awaiting them. Krishna was white marble and held a silver flute. Radharani's right hand, palm forward, extended a benediction. They were beautiful. After their first appearance at Chaupati, Radha Rasa Vihari had moved to the Akash Ganga building, where gradually the devotees had established a decent standard of deity worship. When Prabhupada had left orders that Radha Rasa Vihari should move to Juhu as soon as the down payment was made, some of the devotees had questioned him. Why should the deity move before the facilities were proper? Shouldn't they wait until the temple was built? But Prabhupada had replied, once the deity is installed on a piece of property, no one will remove them. More than anyone else, Prabhupada was aware of the proper worship to be offered to Radha Rasa Vihari, but his emphasis now was on securing the land. How else, he reasoned, could he eventually give Radha Rasa Vihari a royal throne and a temple unless they themselves first established their right of proprietorship by taking up residence at Hare Krishna land? The arrival of Radha Rasa Vihari at Juhu also meant increased difficulties for the devotees, who now had to struggle to maintain the morning puja and cook 6 daily offerings in the meager kitchen. Even Radha Rasa Vihari's tent was insubstantial and swayed in the wind. Srila Prabhupada, however, saw the move as a necessary transcendental tactic. He felt certain that everyone involved, himself, the owners of the land, the Bombay municipality, would accept that the land belonged to Krishna, since Krishna was already residing there. And because he was asking Lord Krishna himself to accept these inconveniences, he prayed to the deity, "My dear sir, please remain here, and I shall build a beautiful temple for you." By the time Prabhupada returned to Bombay, Radha Rasa Vihari were installed on the stage of the festival pandal. Attendance at the festival was not as great as it would have been in downtown Bombay. No more than 500 people came a night, but Prabhupada was satisfied. This festival was on their own property, and this was only the beginning. Every evening, Prabhupada lectured at the pandal and attended the kirtan and arti before Radha Rasa Vihari. Pancha Dravida Swami had collected donations of 5 tons of dal, rice and flour, and the devotees were regularly cooking enough khichdi to serve 125 people free prasadam daily. In the evening, Prabhupada himself would give out halwa from the deity's plate, and the crowd, including well-to-do businessmen and their wives, would press forward to receive the prasadam. Prabhupada liked the festival so much that he told the devotees to arrange to keep the tent for a perpetual festival. Prabhupada lived on the land in a tent, just like the other devotees, until a Mr. Acharya, one of the more favorable tenants living in the back of the property, invited him to stay at his home. Within a few days of his arrival at Juhu, Prabhupada was ready to hold the groundbreaking and cornerstone laying ceremony, another tactic for securing possession of the land. But it was more than a tactic, as he wanted a temple constructed as soon as possible. Radha Rasa Vihari should not remain standing in a tent, but should be protected by a silver and teak wood singhasan on a marble altar. they should be surrounded by deities of the two gopis, Lalita and Vishakha, and their temples should have marble domes more than 100 feet high. Thousands should come daily for darshan and prasadam. One morning, in the midst of the festival activities, the devotees of Hare Krishna land joined Prabhupada in a simple cornerstone laying ceremony. They had dug a deep ceremonial pit and surrounded it with bricks. Prabhupada descended and placed the deity of Shesha. Then, sitting on a simple platform, Prabhupada accompanied the kirtan by playing a brass gong, while one by one the devotees came before him and threw the dirt into the pit, filling it, while smoke rose from the sacrificial fire. Prabhupada was outraged that Brahmananda Swami had agreed to pay the contractors 40,000 rupees for the pandal construction. It was the same old thing, the foolish Western disciples getting cheated. Prabhupada refused to pay. 4,000 rupees should be more than enough. When the contractors came to see him, he told them that he had little money and that they would have to be satisfied with 4,000 rupees. They protested, but Prabhupada became angry and insisted, "Accept it. You are making 500% profit." "As soon as they see us," Prabhupada said later, "they say, 'These Americans, they have got money.' Our work is going on in India, but as soon as money is being spent, 50% is being spoiled because you Americans are inexperienced. What can be done? The Indians want your money, and they cheat like anything." During the Pandal festival, the tenement neighbors had become disturbed by kirtans over the loudspeaker. They were already disturbed that their landlord, Mr. N., was slow to repair the buildings and would sometimes let them go a full week without water before fixing the plumbing. Being suddenly forced to live with more than 20 American devotees only exacerbated their dissatisfaction. Some of the neighbors were converted Christians and unsympathetic to Vaishnavism. They even feared that their children might again be converted to Hinduism. Some tenants claimed the devotees were infringing on their privacy. Some criticized the devotees for arguing among themselves, and others criticized that the unmarried men and women were living in close proximity, even though in separate quarters. A few of the neighbors, however, could see that the Western Vaishnavs were struggling to sincerely worship Radha and Krishna. None of the tenants criticized Prabhupada, however, so when he was present, he was able to pacify them and resolve any disagreements. But Prabhupada knew that after he left, the situation could easily become volatile. Prabhupada was planning an extensive world tour, traveling eastward to Australia, Japan, Hawaii, the U.S., and perhaps Mexico and Europe. It might be as long as half a year before he would return to India, and he wanted things to progress smoothly in Bombay without him. A few days before Prabhupada's departure, Madhudvisha Swami complained, "I'm not feeling very enthusiastic here. I think I need a change." Prabhupada asked him where he wanted to go, and Madhudvisha replied that he was thinking of Australia. Prabhupada said, "Yes, I am going there. You also come." Brahmananda Swami told Prabhupada that the preaching was deteriorating in Nairobi in his absence, and Prabhupada agreed that he should return to his duties there. Again, Prabhupada had to choose a new Bombay manager, and this time he chose Giriraj, a young brahmachari and leading preacher in making ISKCON Life members. Prabhupada reasoned that since the essence of management was to collect donations and make life members, and since Giriraj was expert at that, then even though he was young and otherwise inexperienced, he had the most important qualifications. Prabhupada had already found Giriraj to be simple and submissively dedicated to helping him develop Hare Krishna land. Giriraj remembers, Srila Prabhupada said, "You will do, Giriraj?" So I said, "Yes, Srila Prabhupada, whatever you say." I wasn't actually very happy about it, but I understood that one should be surrendered to the spiritual master, and whatever he said, one should do. So I accepted. Prabhupada said that good management meant that whatever needs doing, you do it. That's all. Later I went in to see Srila Prabhupada, and he was sitting behind his desk. He said, "Now the full responsibility is on you." I winced when he said that, because I wasn't used to taking responsibility. During Prabhupada's stay in Bombay, Hans Keilman, a young architect from Holland, had come to hear the lectures and had become interested in Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada convinced Hans to become a devotee and to help build the Hare Krishna city in Bombay. Under Prabhupada's direction, Hans at once began to make architectural drawings for the buildings. Hans recollects, Prabhupada said, "Now you listen carefully. Lord Krishna has sent you here. You must design these temples for him. You must do these very sincerely and not be afraid." I was completely surrendered. That moment was really ecstasy for me. He had a pile of photographs on his desk, and he gave them to me and said, "Look at this." I looked at the pictures, and they were photographs of the new Govindaji temple in Vrindavan. He said, "I want you to make a design like this." So I asked him, "How big, Srila Prabhupada?" He gave me a piece of typing paper and said I should draw on this paper. Then he gave me the photographs and a pencil and a ruler. He took me to the next room and told me to sit down at the table. Pradyumna was there with all his Sanskrit books. Shyamasundara was there typing the letters, and suddenly I was in between making the drawings. Prabhupada said Giriraj and the others would have to collect 64 lakhs of rupees for the construction. The devotees had no idea how they would raise even a fraction of that amount, but Prabhupada gave them some ideas. He talked to them about enlisting the support of influential men by using the Bhent Nama system, whereby a person purchases the use of a guest room for life. And there were other ways. But the immediate step was to get the land. They had possession of the land, but before building, they should have the deed. Since Mr. N was already overdue in delivering the deed, Prabhupada told Giriraj to press him to comply with the written agreement and deliver the deed at once. In Prabhupada's last lecture in Bombay, he spoke about the six Goswamis of Vrindavan and the bittersweet ecstasy of their hankering to be with Krishna. Some of Prabhupada's disciples took it that Prabhupada was speaking about this because he was himself going to be leaving for a long time. At the airport the next day, there was a joyful farewell as Prabhupada waited for his flight to Australia. Sitting in the VIP lounge, surrounded by devotees, Prabhupada watched Madhudvisha Swami lead an ecstatic kirtan. "If you go on having kirtans like this," Prabhupada told the devotees, "our Bombay project will be successful." When Prabhupada saw that Mrs. N had come, he exclaimed, "Oh, Mrs. N, you are also here. You are becoming one of us." Prabhupada had the extraordinary ability to bring a spiritual vision into physical reality, to change a part of the material world into spiritual energy so that even a common man could perceive the spiritual reality. This was Prabhupada's constant effort. Often a transcendentalist hesitates to deal with the material world, fearing he may become spiritually weakened. The Vedic injunctions, therefore, warn the transcendentalist to avoid associating with money and materialistic persons. But Prabhupada, following the principles taught by Srila Rupa Goswami, saw that everything material had the potential of being used in the service of Krishna, and thus of regaining its spiritual nature. Following this principle, an expert devotee, although apparently acting within the material sphere, could remain always in touch with the spiritual energy. For such a devotee, nothing was material. In the Vedic scriptures, the great devotee Narad Muni, because of his ability to convert materialistic men into devotees, is referred to as Chintamani, touchstone. Just as Chintamani is said to convert iron into gold, so Narad could transform a beast-like hunter into a pure Vaishnav. And as Narad is glorified in the Vedas for accomplishing such feats in bygone ages, so Srila Prabhupada is a similarly potent touchstone in the present age. Again and again, he showed by his straightforward application of Krishna consciousness that he could change a materialist into a completely renounced, active devotee of the Lord. And now, after recruiting a number of devotees from Maya's camp, he wanted to engage them in transforming as much as possible of the material world into living spirit. By his transcendental visionary words, he was attempting to convert stone and human energy into glorious spiritual temples. While ambitious materialists sometimes criticize transcendentalists as unproductive, Prabhupada, because of his constant activity, could never be so accused. Rather, people would criticize him as being a capitalist in the dress of a sannyasi. But such criticism never deterred Prabhupada. He was carrying out the desires of the previous acharyas. He had written this conclusion in his Srimad Bhagavatam even before coming to America in 1965. He had said, quote, "Therefore, all the sages and devotees of the Lord have recommended that the subject matter of art, science, philosophy, physics, chemistry, psychology, and all the other branches of knowledge should be wholly and solely applied in the service of the Lord." Unquote. Prabhupada wanted to convert significant portions of the material world into the spiritual world. In attempting to construct a spiritual city in Juhu, he realized he was launching a major attack against Maya. Within a few months, so many complications and headaches had already disturbed his plans, and more would come. The battle was just beginning. Sometimes Prabhupada's disciples found the work to be draining and stressful. They would become bewildered. They had come to spiritual life for bliss, not for anxiety. Prabhupada's presence and his constant encouragement helped them remain steadfast. He knew that once they tasted the nectar of selfless dedication to Krishna, they would never accept anything less. He would encourage them, reminding them of the words of spiritual predecessors like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who had said, "Difficulties undertaken in the course of your devotional service, I will consider the greatest happiness."